everybody, and welcome back to Fueling Forward Friday. I'm your host, Maddie Alm, registered dietitian and former elite runner. Today's episode, I will be answering questions you all have submitted to me beforehand. And if you would like to submit any questions in the future, you can do so at my website, www.fuelingforward.com, under the podcast tab, or you can send me an email at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Fueling Forward podcast. I wanted to start today's episode by just thanking everyone who has been sending in questions. I've been getting so many questions and so many great questions, and some of them are overlapping, which is always really fun for me because I always tell people that if you have a question, chances are somebody else out there also has the same question. So I would say I can confirm that from looking at my questions list. So definitely keep them coming. If you guys have questions or multiple questions, feel free to submit them. I'm always working my way through them and trying to get through as many as I can. So thank you so much to everyone who has submitted so far. Let's see, just a quick update on training. So as you guys may have heard, I'm going to be running the New York City Marathon in November. And it's funny because I was kind of thinking about this recently. In a couple weeks, I will be almost exactly 1 year since I retired from professional running, which is so crazy. In some ways, it feels like so much longer, but in a lot of ways, it feels like it hasn't been that long. And I think the biggest shift for me has just been that I have been really enjoying a year of unstructured training. You know, I've been training for something since I was 15. I loved every second of my training. You know, there are definitely aspects of it that I miss, but I think for me, the hardest part of the last few years of my professional career was maintaining high mileage. I don't know what it is. I'm not a natural high mileage girly. It is just sometimes, to be totally honest, it's hard for me to get out the door when I have a 10-mile easy run or I have to do 2 runs in a day. That was always just something that took a lot of mental fortitude for me to consistently do. And I did it. I got it done. You know, it was always good once I got out there. But I think the last year, it has been so refreshing for me to just run when I feel like running, run as far as I feel like running, which it's funny, that's another piece that's been totally different is that I think in my head I was like, oh, I'll run, you know, like 40 miles a week. It'll be super easy. I have barely been running 15 miles a week. I don't know what it is, but getting past 3-4 miles has been a huge mental block for me this past year. And I think part of that is just coming off of this really big period of training, and needing a break from that structure and that high mileage. But there's also just a really convenient 3.5-mile out and back like loop I do from my apartment. And if I want to go any longer, I have to add on. And I live in like near the Hollywood Hills, so it's super hilly around me. And so there, I just haven't really found a super great route and haven't been able to motivate myself to drive somewhere. So there are options and I'm working on that. But I think it's funny, like reflecting back on just what I thought I was going to be doing after retirement versus what I have been doing. It's been a little different, but I think it's really been much needed, and I'm trying really hard now to get myself back into a little more structure with training, just so that I'm ready for marathon training, because I'm going to have to increase my mileage a little bit and be more intentional with that. So my goal for May is to work my way up to 20 miles a week, which I'm definitely getting there. In June, I'm trying to get up to 30 miles a week. And then July, I'm trying to get up to 40 miles a week. And then I'll kind of stay between like 40 and 50 miles per week throughout my entire marathon build and training block. So that's also going to be nice to be a little lower mileage than what I used to be. So yeah, I'm just trying to build my way up there. And yeah, it's funny how you can go from running 80 miles a week 1 year to feeling like 15 miles a week is a lot. That's just the reality of the sport. Sometimes it feels like it's you could run forever, and sometimes it doesn't. And that's what I love about running, is that it can be there for me no matter what. But yeah, trying to get my butt into gear, running a little bit more. So that is where I am with my marathon training. And speaking of fall marathons, a couple kind of exciting Fueling Forward announcements before I get into answering questions. I am going to be doing a group coaching program for fall marathons this fall. So if you're somebody who's running a fall marathon and you've wanted to address your nutrition, this group program is going to be super cool because it's going to be 12 weeks. So there'll be a weekly session. Most of them are going to be nutrition focused, but I'm going to have some guest speakers that will come in and share their experiences with marathons. I'm going to have, you know, a mental performance coach and some strength coaches and just some other people to help give you some guidance around preparing mentally and physically for the marathon. We'll definitely be focusing on, you know, nutrition, building your own fueling plan and schedule, working on fueling during your training sessions, building a race day fueling plan, and having plenty of time to practice for that. So that's going to be super, super fun. It'll also include blood work beforehand, which I think is super important for all marathoners. So that's definitely something that a lot of people that I work with don't have or haven't gotten in a while. And also we'll be interpreting it through a sports performance lens. So that's another key, is that what I'm looking for in my runners is very different than what a general population practitioner is looking for. So if you're interested in that, the registration process will be opening up this summer. So you can head over to my website and sign up for the waitlist if that's something you are interested in doing. Signing up for the waitlist just means you'll be able to apply first, and I'm limiting it to 10 athletes total. So it'll go first come, first serve order. So if you're on the waitlist, you'll be a priority, which is really cool. So feel free to sign up for the waitlist if that sounds like something you might be interested in. And then the second thing I'm going to be adding this summer are some summer boot camp series for high school runners. So I'm going to do two different sessions, one in June and one in July. They'll be 4 weeks long. We'll do one meeting per week, and I'll have office hours built in so you can schedule a quick session with me if you have questions. But we're going to be covering everything from how to build your plate during the day to how to fuel for your afternoon practices, fuel for race day. So if you're going to be training for fall cross country season and you're a high school runner, this the summer boot camp series would be a really great opportunity for you just to learn. I'm also going to include blood work in that one because, again, I really wish more high school runners were getting blood work done with their preseason physicals. When I was coaching in Colorado at the high school level, we had a ton of kids who had low ferritin, low iron, which we found kind of late in the season, so it had started to impact their races, and it takes about 6 to 8 weeks for your body to bring iron levels back up after making changes. So sometimes if we wait too long in the season to get that tested, it can be a little bit too late to correct that in time to feel different for the season. So again, something that I think is really important for high school runners, something I wish I had done when I was in high school. So the sign up for that one is open and, again, limited to 10 athletes per session. So if you're interested, you can head to my website under the group coaching program page and check that out. Okay, let's get started with today's questions. So the first question here comes from Abigail. Abigail says, "Hi, thank you for putting your info out there on the podcast. I ran track and cross country and swam in high school, and now I run marathons in college. It can be hard to shake ideas and habits of controlling my intake or criticizing the way I look regardless of performance. When I need a warm hug on a psychologically tough day, I listen to your podcast because it reminds me of what I know to be true underneath my feelings, that underfueling is a path of destruction leading towards the shell of who I want to be, and eating less than what I will need will not result in success. I am also studying biochemistry, and so I love when you get into the nitty-gritty of how this stuff actually works. My question is, as a busy student with work, labs, and classes, I likely sometimes fail to get in enough fuel, especially on easier training days when I'm less intentional or really busy. I'm pretty good about making certain I have more caloric and nutritious meals after hard training days, but sometimes if I have struggled to fuel earlier in the week, I feel that I run out of energy more quickly on my long runs or workouts later in the day, even if I have eaten recently that day or had a good dinner the night before. Can within-day energy deficits still affect workout days later? Lastly, how important is buying organic? Because I don't want to be slowly killing myself with toxic sprays, but I need to live frugally. Is this worth it? Thanks for what you do, and I love your snack recs. Keep them coming. Abigail, thank you so much. That was very kind, really made my day to read that. So I appreciate those kind words. And yeah, I mean, I would definitely say I've been there before. I know how challenging it can be to fuel when you have so much going on. So, you know, the first portion of your question where you asked about those within-day deficits, that is a really important thing that you highlighted, and I'm really glad that you brought that up. So just for anyone listening who doesn't know what that means, essentially a within-day deficit is the amount of time that your body is spending in a deficit between periods of eating. So what's really interesting is that the more research that has been done on athletes with REDS and athletes who don't have a regular period, we have actually seen that if that athlete has a larger within-day deficit, even if they're eating enough calories in a day, they are at a higher risk for REDS or amenorrhea, which is the loss of your period. So that is definitely something that is valid to think about, you know. Within-day deficits do play a really big role in maintaining a good energy balance so that you can support your training and recovery and reduce your risk for injuries. That said, I know it can be really difficult to navigate that when you're kind of gone all day long or you're in classes back to back. I know I was obviously a science major myself, and in labs we were not allowed to eat, of course, or even drink anything. So that can certainly present its own challenges. So I think if you find yourself in that situation, the first thing to remember is that this is temporary. This is not a permanent schedule for you. This is not how your life will be indefinitely. This is just something that's right now. And so remembering that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and just doing your best to give yourself grace within that time period. The second thing I will say is with that kind of a schedule, with those kind of days, planning ahead is absolutely key. And this was certainly something I learned trial and error over time, learned the hard way. But for me, what helped the most was really being intentional about using my time on the weekends to plan and prepare for the week ahead. So the biggest thing was always going to the store on the weekend and making sure that I bought enough items to get me through the entire week. A good example of that would be if I wanted to have an apple with my lunch every day, buying 3 apples, I would run out by Wednesday and then kind of be left in the lurch. So that's something to keep in mind is quantity. How many days am I planning to eat this? It can cause your grocery bill to be a little bit higher up front, but I would argue that overall you end up spending less money because then you're not starving on campus, going to the coffee shop, buying a coffee and a pastry, which ends up being $10, you know, instead of having a slightly higher grocery bill and then not spending any additional money. So that's also something to keep in mind that can take practice. Taking advantage of time you have on the weekends to prepare some things ahead of time that you can bring for the week. So some good examples would be things like baked oatmeal or overnight oats to have for grab-and-go breakfast, making muffins or energy bites to have for snacks during the week, cooking meals. So for me, I would always have some time to cook dinner. Like the earliest I would get home would be maybe like 4 o'clock, you know, and then there would be some nights where I'd have a class until 7 o'clock. Choosing to cook on that night where I had a class until 7 just never worked out well for me. I was hungry, I was tired, and then by the time I ate, it was super late. So what I would try to do is plan the nights I was going to cook dinner for the nights that I had the least going on, or the nights that I was going to be getting home the earliest. And then I would just make sure to cook enough that I could have leftovers to reheat on those nights that I was super busy. And then I would say the final key is just making sure that you pack your bag for the next day, the night before. This one was huge because no matter what I told myself, oh, I'll get this in the morning, I would forget something. I would forget a snack. I would forget, you know, whatever. So if I took some time and set everything out on the counter in a little pile or packed it in my bag, or if I had some refrigerated things that I was going to put in my lunchbox, I would kind of group those in the fridge so I could just kind of swipe them into my lunchbox and go. Then my next day would always be easier and I would almost always have the things that I need. So those are some strategies to make sure you have everything with you. In terms of figuring out when to eat those things, you know, obviously the goal, like I've said before, is to try to eat about every 3 to 4 hours, but that may not always be possible. So if you're heading into a lab, that's going to be 2 hours, and it's kind of would be in the middle of that time frame. Have something small before your lab and then have something when you get out from your lab. So it might end up being that you're eating sooner than 3 hours. You know, like if you had lunch at 11 and your lab is at 1, you know, you could kind of throw back some trail mix at 12:55 before you walk into your lab, and then you could make sure to have a more substantial snack after your lab is over. So it might just mean that you're squeezing things in when possible, and if you had eaten fairly recently, they may be a little bit smaller, but that's okay. You know, just doing the best that you can with the time that you have. Sometimes liquids, depending on the class that you're in, if you're able to drink something, you can turn to a protein drink or a drinkable Greek yogurt or a smoothie, you know, something that you don't have to use your hands to eat, but that you could still get something in. That can also be really helpful during classes. You also mentioned that you feel like you're more intentional with this on hard days. And I do see this a lot where athletes are better at fueling on hard days because they feel maybe like they've earned it more or maybe like it's more important. But something that I do try to remind athletes of is even though it was an easy day and even if your mileage was less, the next day you likely have a hard run. And so underfueling on an easy day does not set you up to get the most out of that workout the next day. And especially in the middle of a training block when you only maybe have one day in between hard days, how you recover makes a huge difference in the long run with your ability to get through that training block and stay healthy. So even though hard days, obviously it's important to make sure you're refueling and recovering on those days, it's still important to remember to do that on easy days. So just keep that in the back of your mind. You're not just fueling for today, you're also fueling for tomorrow, this week, the month, and the entire training block. So every single day does matter. And then the last part of your question asking about organic. That's so funny. I actually wrote about this in my newsletter last week, my Sunday Brunch Club newsletter. So with organic, you know, there is a difference in what is considered an allowable level of pesticides, even types of pesticides and chemicals used to farm in organic. But regardless, all of our food has to meet certain standards by the USDA. So conventionally grown food still is not allowed to have a certain amount of pesticide residue present. So all of our foods are regulated, at least right now they are. I don't know where that's headed, but at this point in time, all of our food is regulated. And the difference in conventional versus organic is just what's allowed to be used. So for organic, you're not allowed to use any type of synthetic, man-made pesticide or, you know, chemical. But I do think an important distinction is that that doesn't mean it's pesticide-free. Organic farmers are still allowed to use certain pesticides. There's an approved list of pesticides for organic farming out there. They just tend to be less of the synthetic, but it doesn't necessarily mean that those pesticides are less harmful. So I think that's kind of a misconception, is that organic means no pesticides, and that's not really true. So I know that organic is more expensive. A couple rules of thumb that I use when people ask if they should buy organic: if there's something that you eat daily and you're eating the skin, so for example, apples, that may be something that's worth buying organic. But if it's something that you're only eating occasionally, you know, maybe a couple times a week, and you're not eating the peel, so for example, a banana, it would make more sense to buy conventional in that case. If you are just generally unable to afford organic, that is totally fine. the best way to kind of reduce exposure to pesticides is to thoroughly wash your produce. So there are produce washes out there that you can get. Trader Joe's has one. Dr. Bronner's peppermint soap is actually really good to use for fruit or vegetable wash. You just put a couple drops in some water and you soak the fruit. Or you can just use water and baking soda and soak the fruit or your produce for a little bit, rinse it thoroughly. That will help remove pesticide residue. One thing to keep in mind is typically when you wash produce, it goes bad faster. So I would recommend, especially for things like berries, washing them in batches right before you're planning to eat them. Otherwise, it can cause them to mold a lot faster. Really great questions, Abigail. Thank you. Okay, this next question says, I'd like to hear your take on pure maple syrup for during race fuel for marathon and ultra. How does it compare in terms of carb concentration, electrolytes, expected ease of digestion, or GI distress, etc.? Yeah, great question. So talking a little bit about, I would say, like the synthetic form of fuel, gels, you know, things that are made in a lab or things that are made by humans as opposed to naturally available. The goal of gels is typically to provide a very specific dose of carbohydrates per serving. So it helps athletes know how many gels or how many chews or how much drink mix they need to use to hit their carb goals because they're pre-packaged in those servings. And then most of the sports nutrition products out there use multiple sources of carbohydrates. So within our GI tract, we have glucose transporters. We also have fructose transporters. Most sports nutrition products use a combination of glucose and fructose because we can oversaturate one transporter faster than if we had two sources of fuel and we have two different pathways available to us. So if something is pure glucose, we can tolerate less of it at once compared to if something is both fructose and glucose. So 20 grams of glucose may not be absorbed as well as 20 grams of sucrose, which is both glucose and fructose. So that is something that a lot of sports nutrition products try to include is different carbohydrate sources, which allows you to take in more per hour. Maple syrup is actually a good example of that occurring in nature. So maple syrup is pretty much purely sucrose, meaning it's equal parts glucose and fructose. So maple syrup would be a great example of a real food option compared to a gel where we're going to be able to get those two carbohydrate sources naturally occurring in nature. 2 tablespoons of maple syrup is about the equivalent of grams of carbs as a gel. So it's about 20 to 25 grams of carbs. So that is really easy. The thing I would say about maple syrup is it is probably not going to be the most convenient option to bring with you on the trails. A bottle of maple syrup, figuring out how to get 2 tablespoons, a little bit complicated, very sticky, probably very messy. Definitely requires that you wash it down with water. That's something to keep in mind too, depending on the type of gel. If it's what's called an isotonic gel, so the concentration of the gel more similarly matches our GI tract, then we don't actually have to take it with fluids at the same time. So examples of that would be like Science and Sport or Morton gels. Those are nice because you don't have to take them with fluids. But something like goo or honey stinger or maple syrup, you know, would require you to take them with fluids in order to best absorb those electrolytes and carbs. So that's something else to consider is just making sure you have fluids available. You asked about electrolytes. Maple syrup does have some naturally occurring electrolytes like potassium and chloride. It does not have much sodium. So it only has about 5 milligrams of sodium. I typically tell athletes to try to get about 300 milligrams of sodium per hour during a training session, a marathon, or an ultra, sometimes even more if it's hotter or more humid, or you're a super salty sweater. So maple syrup would not be the best option for replenishing electrolytes. You would probably want to bring with you an electrolyte drink as well. But in terms of digestion, GI distress, it would be pretty comparable to a lot of gels out there. Going back to the challenge of convenience, I think that's probably the biggest limiting factor. There are products out there that use pure maple syrup. So Untappd is a brand that packages maple syrup as gels. So they actually have gels that are pure maple syrup. So that might be something fun to play around with if you're somebody who is interested in using a real food option like maple syrup. Honey Stinger similarly has a gel that's pure honey. So that's another one that's kind of a combination of glucose and fructose. But I will say honey is higher fructose, which can be more likely to cause GI issues for people, especially for women. Women have a harder time digesting fructose compared to men. So that may be something to consider if you're thinking of something natural like honey versus maple syrup, would be that fructose content. But yeah, there's no reason why you couldn't use maple syrup as your during run fuel. I think just keeping in mind like flavor fatigue, like if you were purely using maple syrup for an entire ultra, that might get a little difficult. So having some alternative options, kind of mixing it in with other sports nutrition products would maybe be the best thing there. But yeah, certainly something that you could use as long as you have another source of hydration and electrolytes. All right, this next question says, hello, I have a question regarding weight gain during marathon training. I've been training for my first 50K for the past few months and recently stepped on the scale out of curiosity. It showed I am 4 to 5 pounds heavier than I usually am. I will say that I have increased the amount that I am eating due to my training level and my history of underfueling. Is it normal to gain weight while training, or am I possibly overfueling now? Super, super great question, and I'm guessing a lot of people listening have experienced this before. So gaining weight during marathon or ultra training is actually super common, and there's a couple reasons why this can happen. One is fluid retention. Just from the amount of training we're doing, we can actually see more fluid retention just from changes in the way our body is moving things. We can also see an increase in muscle mass. So of course, our first assumption when we see the number on the scale go up is that it's bad. But keep in mind, muscle also takes up place in our body. Bone density takes up some space and some weight in our body. So if we're increasing muscle mass, if we're increasing bone density, those are definitely two things that can also cause the number on the scale to go up. Increased glycogen stores, muscle glycogen stores. So a lot of times when we are doing more endurance training, we're more efficient at storing energy like glycogen in our muscles, which is going to cause the number on the scale to look higher, but it's not a true change in weight. It's just a change in energy availability. So that's certainly something that can happen with training. Another maybe more common cause of weight gain during marathon or ultra training, especially if this is something you're new to, is poor fueling or recovery causing your cortisol levels to increase. So cortisol is a stress hormone that our body produces in response to any type of stress, whether that's emotional, physical, mental, life stress, whatever it is, our body mounts the same exact stress response every time it perceives stress. So when we radically increase our training volume or intensity or otherwise compared to what we used to do, this can cause your cortisol levels to increase, especially if you are underfueling or you're not recovering well, meaning you're not taking your easy days easy, you're not building in maybe an off day or a cross training day, or you're just going too hard all the time. That can also contribute to high cortisol, which can affect things like body fat storage. So we tend to see increased body fat storage with high cortisol levels. We also see a decrease in metabolic rate if we're under fueling, which can cause, you know, weight changes that way from slowing down your metabolism. So there could be a lot of different factors at play. There also could be an issue with fluctuating how much you're eating throughout the week. So if you are, for example, under fueling on easy days, you may be overfueling on hard days or long run days because you're really hungry and your body's in a deficit and it's trying to make up for that. So most of the time, being more consistent with your fueling, being more intentional with your fueling, balancing your plates, fueling before and after all of your training sessions, all of that can help keep day-to-day fueling more consistent so that we're not seeing periods of underfueling followed by periods of overcompensating with overfueling. The last thing I'll say is you mentioned that you had a history of underfueling, and I think it's just important to highlight that because in those cases, if an athlete starts fueling how they should be and their weight goes up, maybe that's something that needed to happen. And maybe that's actually a good thing. I think, again, as a society, we're taught that weight gain equals bad. Weight gain equals we've failed or we've done something wrong. And that's not true. Weight fluctuations are very normal throughout our lives, throughout the month, throughout the year. Women especially, we can see 10-pound differences between different cycle phases, which is crazy. So if you're weighing yourself, you know, in your luteal phase, the second half of your cycle, you may see your weight much higher than it is during your follicular phase or the first half of your cycle. So there can be a lot of different factors here that are not in our control. And again, weight gain inherently is not bad. Sometimes that actually needed to happen for us to be healthy, for us to build muscle, for us to be able to respond to our training. Sometimes that's just something that needs to happen. So if I have an athlete who has a history of underfueling, and they're noticing that when they start eating what they should be, the weight on the scale goes up, the first thing I would say is, you know, as hard as it can be to accept that sometimes, it may be something that needed to happen. The other thing I would say is weight is not going to be the best indication of fitness or performance. So if you're generally feeling good, if you're recovering well, if you're not sore all the time, you're sleeping well, you have good energy and a good mood, then chances are you're adequately fueling and there's no reason we need to weigh ourselves. That doesn't help us. We're not going to change what we're doing with our training or our fueling. If anything, for most of us, when we step on the scale, we don't feel very good when we step on, and then it can ruin our day or cause us to question our fueling choices or our training choices, and just cause a lot of distress there. So I don't typically encourage athletes to weigh themselves regularly because it's just not a helpful metric. There are other things that we can use to measure how we're feeling and how we're fueling. So I think just reminding yourself if you're in that position, weight changes, they happen, they vary a lot from day to day. There's a lot of different factors that could be contributing to that change in weight. It doesn't always mean it's a true weight change, gain or loss. It can just mean fluid shifts or energy store shifts, you know, things like that as well. But generally, trying not to use weight as a metric for performance is my suggestion there. Okay, I actually got two of these questions this week, so I'm happy to be answering this one. This question says, what is the science behind creatine for distance and marathon runners? Is this something that I need to be taking, or is this just another social media fad? So let's start with defining what creatine actually is. Creatine is an amino acid-based compound, and we store it in our muscles, and we use it to produce something called ATP. So if you've ever taken biology or chemistry and you've been scarred by having to memorize the Krebs cycle, you probably remember that ATP is the molecule that our body produces for energy. It's the source of energy for all of the cells in our body, including our muscles. So that is something that creatine is involved in, is the production of ATP. The other thing that I'll say about creatine is that it's actually one of the most well-researched sports nutrition supplements out there. It's known as what's called an ergogenic aid, meaning it's something that can naturally help improve performance. And there is a lot of science behind it. So it is a generally safe supplement for everybody. It's a well-researched supplement. So most of the time when people are asking me about supplements, I can't say that. So that is a difference, I would say, with creatine versus other supplements, is that it is very well researched. So for endurance runners specifically, there's a couple reasons why having more creatine can be beneficial. The more creatine that we have stored in our muscle, that means the more ATP that we can produce and the faster we can produce it, meaning we will see improved recovery and energy available for that actual aerobic workout. So the research that has been done on endurance runners has shown that it can help endurance athletes maintain a higher intensity for longer before burning out. And it can also help you recover faster between intervals. So let's say you're doing, you know, 4x1K, an athlete who has been using creatine might recover faster for their 90 seconds rest compared to an athlete who has not been. And those are some of the situations where we call them like the one percenters. So if you are at the highest level of athletics and every second counts, being able to recover faster between intervals means that you can push harder, which means you can gain more from your training, which means on race day, you'll be able to maybe outlean that competition and get that third spot instead of that fourth spot to qualify for the Olympics. So it's typically pretty minor improvements that we're talking about, very minimal. For some athletes, that makes all the difference in the world, and for others, it may not necessarily be worth it. It also has a bigger effect for shorter distances. So with the 100 and the 200 being the most beneficial, and the effect gets smaller as the distance goes up. So as we get closer to like marathon, ultra, the impact that it has on that energy production and aerobic capacity, anaerobic capacity, just gets less because the systems that we're using to compete are a little bit different. We have also seen from research that it can improve quality of strength training workouts, which is a huge factor for things like injury prevention, for recovery, and just general strength gains that help with performance overall. There's even some evidence from a cognitive standpoint. So we've seen in athletes, it can even help prolong mental fatigue. So this is where I'm thinking like marathon, ultra, when you're out there for hours, the mental fatigue can be a really big limiting factor, especially because your perception of pain goes up when you're mentally exhausted. Concentration can go down, so more likely to, you know, step in a pothole or step off the curb wrong or trip over a rock on a trail race or something like that. So it can potentially help prolong mental fatigue. And then even outside of performance, there's some evidence that it can benefit memory and cognitive performance for aging adults. So there is a lot of different aspects that creatine could be beneficial for. Something that's important to keep in mind with most of this stuff is that a lot of times we can get what we need from food. So with creatine, our body actually makes about 1 to 2 grams of creatine daily. And most of us are getting another 1 to 2 grams from food if we consume meat and fish. Those are the two main sources of naturally occurring creatine. Typically, athletes need about 5 grams of creatine daily. So if you are consuming enough from food and your body's able to produce enough, you're pretty much right there. And adding an extra creatine supplement may or may not be beneficial for you. But what we also know is that what we get from diet and what we produce in our body actually might not be enough for optimal creatine. It might be enough for sufficient creatine, but not optimal. And so we may actually not be increasing those creatine stores in our muscle to the point that we would see performance benefits just from food alone. So in those cases, supplementation can definitely help. I would say especially in the case of like vegan athletes or plant-based athletes who are not consuming meat or fish, those may be situations where supplementing with creatine can be really helpful. There's also some research that postmenopausal women can really benefit from creatine supplementation, so that's another thing to consider. There's a lot of misconceptions about creatine out there. I've heard athletes who are concerned about like kidney function or needing to drink an extra gallon of water per day if you're taking creatine. That's not necessarily true. If you have healthy functioning kidneys, there's no additional risk. It doesn't cause any harm. And hydration, as long as you're staying hydrated, you don't need to go above and beyond with getting extra hydration. There has been research studies done to test, does it increase your risk for things like heat exhaustion or dehydration? And those have shown that it does not. So there's no huge concern there, but it does pull water into your muscles. So we can see water retention and some bloating happen with athletes who start using creatine. So it can be uncomfortable for some athletes. It does typically go away after your body adjusts to it, but it's not something I would start like right before you have a big race or something coming up if you don't feel great, if you feel bloated. So starting that early on. We also know it takes consistent use. Research has shown you need to be taking 3 to 5 grams daily for at least 28 days to see a true difference in muscle creatine levels. So if you're somebody who struggles to be consistent with supplements, this may not be that beneficial for you. And then lastly, and this is something I say with every single supplement that I've ever talked about, it does not make up for inadequate fueling. So if you are not already eating 3 meals daily, getting enough carbs, eating before, during, and after training sessions, focusing on your hydration and electrolyte intake, adding creatine is not going to benefit you the way that it would an athlete who's already doing all of those things. I think it's a lot more worth your time, energy, and money to focus on nailing your day-to-day nutrition first before it's worth considering adding something like creatine. I get a lot of questions from teenage athletes and parents of teenage athletes. Should my high school athlete be taking creatine? I don't generally recommend these types of supplements for growing teens. Again, these athletes are going to benefit a lot more from focusing on day-to-day nutrition. And sometimes I would say athletes who are taking creatine think that it's sort of like an insurance policy where, oh, if I'm taking creatine, it's okay if I'm not doing all these other things. So it can kind of create this false sense of like, oh, I'm doing a good job with my fueling, even if they're not. So I generally don't encourage young athletes to use creatine. If I'm going to be using creatine with an athlete, it typically requires that they are doing all the things they should be doing with their fueling. And it's an athlete where it really matters how you're recovering. But again, it's not something that's harmful. And so if you're somebody who's interested in trying it out, there's definitely no harm in doing that, and you certainly can give it a try. It is a pretty easy supplement to integrate. You just want to make sure that you're finding one that's in the form of creatine monohydrate, which is pretty much all creatine supplements out there. Ideally, you want to make sure that it is third-party certified, so like NSF or Informed Sport, Informed Choice certified. Contamination would be a big concern with any powders like creatine or protein powders. So just making sure that you're getting a clean brand, one that's third-party tested. And then the nice thing, too, is that it doesn't matter, like I said, what time of day you're taking it. So you can take it, if it's easier for you to remember to take it at night or in the morning, you can take it before or after running. It's pretty easy to incorporate. There can be some GI issues that come along with it, so I generally don't recommend taking it before running. But it is something that you could easily add to a post-workout recovery drink or smoothie just to get that creatine in there. But remember, at the end of the day, getting in your carbs and protein post-workout, fueling before and during workouts, fueling throughout the day, that's going to be what really makes the biggest difference and moves the needle the most for most athletes with recovery. Creatine is just sort of a bonus on top of that for athletes that need that extra boost. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Fueling Forward podcast. If you have questions that you'd like to submit for a future Q&A session, you can submit them on my website at www.fuelingforward.com under the podcast tab, or you can email me at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Next week's guest is going to be Kara Goucher, who has a very inspiring story navigating many, many different barriers throughout her career. So if you're interested in hearing her story, make sure you tune in next week. Thanks again for being here, and I'll see you at the next Fueling Forward Friday.